of the fear of God is the fact in this world is the fact that in the hereafter, this person who adopted the fear of God, was afraid of God in this world, he will not be afraid and he will remain safe in the hereafter, and God will grant him security, you know, from the fire of hell. Whereas conversely, if somebody is not afraid of God in this world and he doesn't be careful about God's stipulates and his laws and his ordinances in this world, then in the hereafter, this person will be extreme, you know, obviously he will be afflicted with fear and insecurity on the day of resurrection. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at the fruits and consequences of the fear of God and the adoption of the fear of God in this world. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. Allahumma salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad.
This one lay. Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The communique has been issued by G7 leaders. Their aim, Russia and China. They took aim at Beijing on issues like the South China Sea, human rights, and alleged interference in their democracies. Well, China has sat back and said, in fact, it is the G7 that is hindering world peace. So who's at fault here? Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the G7's controversial communique, which said decisions taken by the G7 are aimed at containing Moscow and Beijing. That's something Russia actually said, using Ukraine as a tool to inflict a strategic defeat on Russia, amongst other issues. First, let me introduce our guest. George Zamioli, Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute, joins us from London. We also have Isha Krishnaswamy, who's a podcaster and journalist, joining us from St. Petersburg. Welcome to you both. I'll start with you, George Zamioli. Let's look at what the Russian Foreign Minister has said about this G7 communique. Decisions taken by the group are aimed at the double containment of Russia and China. What does he mean exactly by a double containment?
Well, it's that this very narrow grouping of countries, they are all members of NATO, with the exception of Japan, and Japan is a very close military ally of the United States, obviously. So this very narrow group of countries arrogates to itself the right to rule over the world, to create what it calls the rules-based international order. And who does this group regard as the chief adversaries of this imposed world order? Well, Russia and China. And they, you know, it is quite clear from the very lengthy communique that they issued that they are targeting Russia, obviously, most strongly, but China also. And the communique speaks extensively about China, and it shows, you know, that this very small group of countries regards Russia and China as its chief adversaries.
All right, Ishal, let's take a look at a couple, things that we've drawn out of the communique, which may indicate what Russia meant by this double containment, and I'm wondering what you think. Tightening sanctions against Moscow and then paring back exposure to China also urging China to press Russia to halt its military aggression and immediately withdraw its forces from Ukraine. I take back the first part of what I said. Is the double containment meaning that Russia should be pressured by China to halt its military aggression? Is that the double containment just in that aspect?
I don't think so. I think the double containment refers to the West's wishes to limit the ability for either Russia or China to have foreign relations with other countries in the manner that they see fit. Because as we've seen from like the West's own admission, the G7's own admission, that they see this as a threat to the existing world order that they created in 1944 with the Bretton Woods Conference, the World Bank, the UN, the IMF. So I think that is what they're referring to. But within this, they see Russia as a threat for various reasons. The first one is because Russia does not really roll over. For example, in 2008, when there was the crisis in Ossetia, they sent their troops. And now, and again in 2013 for Syria and here in Ukraine. So Russia really prevents the G7 countries from exerting their desires on other countries. China, with the Belt and Road Initiative and their economic relations in Africa and Latin America, where they're building much needed infrastructure, is again a threat to the existing way the West does business, which is mostly use Africa and Latin America as a raw materials resource from which they suck resources and purposely impoverish the population. So that is what I think Lavrov is referring to as double containment.
Okay. Let's take a look at why Russia is offended, to say the least. Of course, they get offended every day by the U.S. and the G7 as a whole. But George Samioli, taking a look at what Lavrov has said, first of all, it's one thing for the G7, I guess, to use Ukraine as a tool to inflict, a strategic defeat on Russia. That's one thing. But Lavrov is saying that they openly not only want to defeat Russia on the battlefield, but to eliminate it as a geopolitical competitor. I mean, that sounds like eliminating Russia in a sense, doesn't it?
Oh, no question. When the Russian leaders, particularly President Putin, talk about this existential threat to Russia, they have in mind not just the military defeat of Russia in Ukraine, but the destruction of the Russian government and the destruction of the Russian Federation. I mean, it's the West is going all in. It's trying to essentially finish off the job that it started in 1991 with the dissolution of the Soviet Union, but the West somehow was quite happy with Yeltsin and allowed the Russian Federation to survive more or less intact. This time, the West is playing for keeps, and they want to see the Russian Federation gone. So the stakes are very high for Russia, and I think Lavrov's statement, and he's made many statements like that, indicate that, you know, ultimately Russia cannot afford to lose this, because if they lose this war, they lose their whole state.
When we hear, Isha, how, like our analyst there said, for Russia to be gone, the stance of the EU, or for others in the media perhaps saying for Russia to be gone, you know, when you take a look at that statement, it's beyond actually comprehension as to how Russia can be gone. I mean, you know, you can tell us how that is just not something that is based on reality.
It is not based on reality, because Russia has one of the fiercest militaries in the world, and they have one of the most advanced weapons, and the military and the weapon system works very well, so it is unlikely to happen. But that does not change the fact that the West definitely has plans for this. Earlier this year in January, inside the EU headquarters, they had a meeting about the Federation after Russia, where they were planning some kind of Yugoslavia-like Balkanization project. And in the 1990s, they kind of tried a little bit of that with the Chechenian War. So that is definitely in the plans. And of course, it is very highly unlikely that they will realize this plan. But that does not change the threat to the Russian Federation by the West. And again, in Ukraine, we've had the defense minister say that he wants to target ethnic Russians. And for the past 8 years in the Donbas region, they have been doing that, targeting and endangering ethnic Russians. So there is both a danger for people who speak the Russian language and who identify ethnically as Russian, and also the state itself, if they do not fight back against the aggression posed by the West.
All right. Joyce Samueli, instigating instability, human rights violations, interfering in democracies. Mm-hmm. So who do you think is making that statement, Russia and China against the G7 or G7 against Russia and China? Because if you use the if you think of the G7, aren't they guilty, the respective countries, particularly the U.S. and the U.K., of committing the same violations as they have indicated against China in this case?
Well, of course, they've been doing this for decades. The United States has been interfering in elections throughout the world, and it's done worse things. I mean, it's organized assassinations, organized coups, instigated military insurgencies in countries all over the world. But because the Western powers assume that they are on the side of good, they're on the side of the angels, therefore it's obviously a good thing when there is a coup somewhere and the bad guys are removed and the United States is behind it. That's not interference, that's just God's will working on earth. So that's how the West sees it. Now, of course, when any other country seems to be interfering in other countries' affairs, and of course, they do it about 1/100th of the amount that the Western powers do it, then there is absolute indignation. And we remember the hysteria of Russiagate, which went on for 3 years, in which media personalities and politicians were tearing their hair out, screaming that this is the worst thing since 9/11, the Pearl Harbor, and the Kennedy assassination, Russian interference in the American election. So, yeah, I mean, every time the G7 says these things, I mean, you really have to just, take a cool drink.
Well, they're the leading countries, as they claim to be, of the world. Well, Esha, yeah. Another thing that they have voiced, and this is against China, is the militarization in the Asia-Pacific region. And we're not trying to rip apart this communique, but we're trying to understand where they're coming from. So when they talk about China's militarization and how that they think peace and stability should prevail, especially when it comes to the Taiwan Strait, isn't the U.S. the one, however, that's selling military equipment to countries like Taiwan? And correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't Japan for the first time to have unveiled a record budget, for its defense, 20% rise in military sales, of which obviously guess who provides the military equipment to Japan. So who's at fault here?
I would have to say definitely the U.S. First of all, we have to understand how Taiwan got created. It was Chiang Kai-shek's army that basically, when the People's Liberation Army chased them, they fled to Taiwan, and the PLA did not really have a navy, and the U.S. Navy blockaded the region. So that's kind of how Taiwan exists. And both Taiwan and China recognize the one China policy. They just defer on when and how the reunification is going to happen. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is, if we look at a map, it's in the South China Sea, and China has every right to defend its ports in the South China Sea. And I have no idea what the U.S. is doing all the way across the Pacific Ocean. And on top of it, the U.S. is also saber-rattling and trying to move the microchip industry out of Taiwan. And they are also militarizing Taiwan. And they were also involved in the Color Revolution involving the DPP party, because the KMT became too soft for them, who they wanted to do reunification and start negotiating the Tente with China. So I would say it's definitely U.S. is at fault. And China has been doing some sea drills with Russia in the Pacific, but that is a response to the U.S. Navy floats that are humongous, and they're in Samoa, they're in Marshall Islands. So I would definitely, just looking at a map and counting the distance between China and the South China Sea versus the U.S. shows you who's at fault here.
All right. And I'm going to have to also get your take on this, George Samioli, because this is pretty important. Because last time we checked, the U.S. is provoking China in many different ways. There's been plenty of, I should say, alarm bells going off that there's a coming war with China. Not to mention the fact that we're looking at how North Korea, in a sense, is reacting the way it is towards the joint military exercises that the U.S. has held time and again with South Korea and also with Japan. Perhaps they're not looking for a solution there, because that will keep there at least a reason to give the U.S. Justification for its presence there. So this all leads to instability. Isn't that something that the G7 countries take a note of when they're issuing this in their communique?
Well, they should take a note of it, but of course they don't. I mean, because for them, China is just an aggressor state. You know, they're inexplicably doing these terrible things because they're a terrible country, a terrible regime. But of course, you're absolutely right. And what the United States is doing in Taiwan, and they say it explicitly, is pursuing what they call a porcupine strategy. In other words, they keep pouring arms into Taiwan and making it quite a strong, effective military power, so that should there arise a problem, but for instance, for China, they've already said the red line for them is if Taiwan declares independence. In other words, if Taiwan declares independence, they would have to resort to military action. They don't want to do it, but that's the red line. Well, if they pursue this, Americans help pursue this porcupine strategy, then that military action is going to become very, very difficult. And so what the Americans are doing in Taiwan is similar to what they were doing in Ukraine. I mean, they're building it up until the point when Russia was just really was back and forth against the wall and say, well, we can't allow this. We can't allow this armed aircraft carrier on our borders, absolutely rabidly hostile to us with its guns pointing at us. We need to take action. And that could well happen in Taiwan. I mean, the more it gets built up as a formidable military power, the more the Chinese are going to decide we have to do something now before it's too late.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right, so we have about, I think, 17 minutes that we've torn apart the G7 in some sense. So let's look at one of the bright spots here, Aisha. And it was something that von der Leyen said, of which she said it's been described as a PG2. It's an initiative of $600 billion, which sounds like a great amount of money for what she has referred to as top quality infrastructure, where Europe is proud to contribute half of it. I mean, this sounds great, right? But I'm wondering where the $300 billion is going to come from, while at the same time you have Europeans that are suffering so much from a cost of living crisis that they're out on the streets at least on a weekly basis. That kind of goes against their own economies, how people are suffering there. Why wouldn't she want to invest that kind of money in the countries of the EU?
Because we've already determined the EU is a currency union that is based on austerity, and it is a way to enact austerity, privatization, and all the things that purposely impoverish the people. Today, I just read a report that at least 30% of France is now food insecure. And this is the first time in a long time where this has happened. And so, of course, the entire purpose of the EU is to take away monetary sovereignty from the countries and their ability to develop programs for their own citizens and to force them into the Eurozone where they're forced into austerity, like what happened with Greece and what is soon to happen with Italy and Spain. So, yeah, it just goes counter to the design of the EU to actually use it to improve the lives of their own citizens. And as for the infrastructure project, I'm very skeptical of what exactly, what kind of infrastructure they plan on using and what their plans are, because it seems like they haven't been able to do the infrastructure like China or Iran. It just remains to be seen if there are modern and competitive in the 21st century.
Okay, let's move on to the whole issue that they have stressed on, and that is no Chinese decoupling, George Samueli. Based on the communique, it said to coordinate our approach to economic resilience and economic security that is based on diversifying, deepening partnerships, and de-risking, not decoupling. So if they don't want to decouple from China, then why are they pushing to decouple from China?
Yes, that's exactly right. This is the line that they've been taking. You know, they borrowed it from what they've been saying on Russia. So, well, we've got to eliminate our dependence on Russia. Now, they still keep buying stuff from Russia. They keep, you know, they still buy oil, they still buy gas, they still buy food, everything else from Russia, you know, precious metals, diamonds, gold, everything. They're still buying it. But they say, but we are going to cut back on it. We're going to slowly but surely we're going to get less and less and less and less. So that's what they're now trying to, the line they're trying to do on China as well. Well, we're going to cut back on everything that all our dependence on China. And, you know, and we say, look, I mean, it's perfectly reasonable that powers should eliminate their economic dependence on anyone. I mean, you should be self-sufficient to the best of your abilities. But that's not really what's going on here, because, of course, when you look at the EU is becoming a wholly owned subsidiary of the United States. So you may be decoupling from China, but you are not decoupling from the United States. So you're basically... Europe will become wholly dependent on energy imports from the United States, the liquefied natural gas. And, you know, their economies are going to be shipped from your EU, where it's much too expensive, to the United States. And that will be that. That will be that as far as Europe being any kind of an economic power. So, all the talk about, decoupling from China, yeah. But you're in a much worse position than you were before. You are now wholly dependent on the United States.
Indeed. So my final question goes to you, Isha. We have also the G7 that has issued a very strong condemnation on China when it comes to economic threat posed by China. I'm not too sure how that really pans out in their thoughts. But they said that they need to untangle sensitive supply chains from Chinese influence. Now, there's two points here that I can bring up as examples. When it says that they China should be out of the equation when it comes to supply chains, well, wasn't it the U.S. the one that blew up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline that led to a supply chain being disrupted there? And also when it comes to an economic threat, isn't the U.S. at risk of a default in their country of over $31 trillion, which could lead to a worldwide economic recession? Or at a minimum, for there to be a negative economic impact on the world financially?
Oh, the answer is yes to both. So with the supply chain, it is in the 90s, it was Bill Clinton who decided to deindustrialize the U.S. And many companies chose China because back then China had a policy that was easy to create manufacturing there. And so it is kind of the West's own doing that China is involved in the supply chain of so many different industries, but China also has about 1.4 billion people. So it is very hard for anybody in the world to decouple from China. As for the supply chain, yes, the US blew up the Nord Stream. And on top of that, they're the ones who are enforcing sanctions upon Syria, Iran, North Korea, Russia. that really have the deleterious effect on the supply chain. For example, I was speaking to a man who worked at the shipyard here in St. Petersburg, and he was telling me how it is hard for them to build ships because certain parts come from Norway and other parts come from Japan, and they just can't get it. So a lot of them have been, shipping industry has been really hurt. So the West has been doing that. And as for economic coercion, the West has had hundreds of years to build infrastructure in Africa, in Latin America, and in Asia, and they just haven't done it. For example, the UK has had at least 100 years, but China has been able to build the high-speed trains. So it is basically the West crying that China is being able to compete in the marketplace they created.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, we're fresh out of time, Isha. Krishna Aswami, there, podcaster and journalist from St. Petersburg. Thank you. Joyce Samiali, pleasure, senior research fellow, Global Policy Institute, London Metropolitan University, from Budapest. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tawe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, adornment. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about adornment in the Islamic lifestyle. When we look at the Islamic teachings, we see that there is importance of adornment in the Islamic lifestyle. And therefore, when we are raising our kids, when we are nurturing our kids, it is necessary while training them to teach them to give importance to themselves, to give the importance to their appearance. And this is because Allah has given importance to the appearance of this universe. He gave importance to the appearance of the creatures that He created. For example, we can see there are many birds with different colors, and the colors that they have, they're so beautiful. Sometimes we cannot even imagine those colors. The way they have these colors, or the glowing colors, some of the birds, the sounds that they make, the way they sing, all these things, these are the parts of the physical appearance. And in this material world in which we are living, we are not getting bored of this world. Why? Because there is a lot of things to see. And when we are bored, for example, living in the desert area or dry area, we move towards the mountains. We go towards the green area to see the landscapes. If we are bored from the land place, we go towards the seaside. So there are different ways, visiting jungles and all those things. All these things which are the means of relaxation for the mankind is provided by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Therefore, it is necessary to teach our kids about these things and to tell them to give importance to their physical appearance, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of adornment in the Islamic lifestyle. And we said that it is necessary to teach our kids to give importance to their physical appearance. In one of the narrations, it is said by the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa sallam that he said, "Inna Allah yuhibbu," Allah loves, certainly Allah loves, "idha an'ama ala 'abdin," then when he bestows, when he gives a blessing to his servant, and yara athara ni'matihi alayh, to see the effects of that blessing in him. Now, what does it mean? It means that when Allah has given us the beautification, when Allah has put in our nature to beautify ourselves, to look after ourselves, to, for example, you know, comb our hairs. We love to be to look good. It is necessary that he, when he gave us the blessing of the clothes, the good clothes and the place, so he wants to see us in that state. He wants to see us when he has provided the means of clothing, to see us in good clothes. When he has provided the water for us, he wants to see us clean, and he wants to see us in a state of clean. That's why we see that in the Islamic lifestyle, there is importance of bath, there is importance of brushing our teeth, there is an importance of clothing, there is the importance of combing, there is the importance of putting perfume on, and all these things. Why there is an importance? It's because these are the gifts, blessings of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So when he has given us these blessings, he wants us to use them. And when we are using them, on the other way, we are thanking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala by using it. So there are two things. One, we are adorning ourselves. The second thing is that we are thanking Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala because we are using all these means and blessings provided by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
After an intense year of deadly fighting between the Russian and Ukrainian armed forces, Bakhmut and nearby villages have reportedly been seized by Moscow, being an important roadway and industrial center with huge underground salt mines and with a pre-war population of 75,000. Bakhmut, also known as Artyomovsk in Russia, is located about 60 kilometers north of Donetsk, the regional capital of Donbas. The city has been so largely devastated that there are almost no intact buildings left in it. Over 3,500 residents of Bakhmut Artyomovsk have been evacuated and placed in a facility in the neighboring town of Shakhtyrsk.
We left on May 20th, the day of liberation, because the city had been razed so thoroughly that living was impossible. Its destruction continues in this very moment. The level of danger is even higher than 1 to 2 months ago. This is our Stalingrad, but DPR acting head Pushilin has pledged that the city will be reconstructed and restored. We hope it will happen very soon.
Here at the Shakhtar's temporary accommodation center, there are people that fled the unprecedented bloody battles in Bakhmut in recent days. They survived bullets and strikes hitting their towns, but now they have to face a life in ruins.
Most families from Bakhmut Artyomovsk left months ago as fighting in the city became vicious, but now, after several hundred of civilians, including children, have lost their lives, even those who vowed to stay to the end are living. According to Shakhtarsk mayor, about 60 Bakhmut residents arrived in his town on Sunday, and as many will be transferred there shortly.
We spent 1 month hiding in the basement. It was horrible. While the Ukrainian soldiers were shelling our house, I was with my old mother. We never ever got out of our shelter. My mother was losing her mind. She saw things that were not there. One day she was even about to run out of the basement to put an end to her nightmare.
I've been a pensioner for 13 years, conducting a serene life, living with my mother. Our problems began 9 years ago, and we have to thank God if we are still alive today.
Russian forces now face the task of seizing the remaining part of the Donetsk region still under Ukrainian control, including several heavily fortified areas. Meanwhile, fighting around Donetsk is ongoing. Max Civili, Donetsk.
On May 24th of the year 2000, Lebanese masses flocked to their hometowns and villages in a surprise move that shocked the Israeli army and sent the Israeli collaborators fleeing towards northern occupied Palestine. These towns witnessed over 18 years of Israeli occupation, terrorism, killing and destruction. Thanks to the strategy of attrition adopted by the resistance movement, the Israeli army was left with no option but to withdraw unconditionally from the land it had occupied. Since then, Lebanon has celebrated May 25th as a national day of resistance and liberation.
We earned our freedom. It wasn't like they said, oh, we left. No, they didn't left. We make them leave. We make them leave.
Hassan was forced to leave his hometown during the Israeli occupation. He recalls how terrorized he was as a child when the Israelis first invaded South Lebanon.
I was forced to leave my land in 1982, and I was unable to come back until after 2000. It was a great moment. I can tell the difference, like when we used to drive or when we was kids. My parents used to say, don't look, don't smile, don't do nothing, don't breathe even. That's how much we were scared.
Today he brings his son to see the fruit of years of struggle.
After hard work and all the suffering that the army of Hezbollah and went through and fought hard and freed the South Lebanon, Jnoub, and now I can hear with my friends, five of them, all from Canada, they wanted to get a good vacation. We didn't know where to go. And I asked my dad, and he's like, Lebanon, you have to go to Lebanon. Now it's free, beautiful country.
Of course, it shows the strength, of course, of the community. And how you can't take something that, you know, rightfully belongs to someone. And honestly, just overall, it's been beautiful so far here. And it just really shows how much love there is in the city.
After, you know, withdrawal in 2000, you can see the smile in the face of the people, especially the children. They come and they can play and they can walk around in peace. And they are really happy to go to come back to their homeland, which we really paid a lot of blood to get it back. And we are looking forward, really, for the Palestinians to live and to have the same feeling as we feel.
The fruit of liberation is seen by the people of Lebanon as a natural outcome of resistance, and they have voiced their support and encouragement to the Palestinian people that someday they too will be free. Maryam Saleh, Odaisi, South Lebanon.
A
Across France, top unions led another day of strikes aimed at winning the revocation of a recent 2-year hike to the retirement age. With President Emmanuel Macron refusing to budge, many are now demanding the movement expand into a complete general strike.
We must have a general strike to create a new system of society, as our current model allows the government and the bosses to totally ignore our needs. Everybody must get involved because everybody is affected.
Many speculate that Macron is so isolated from everyday French society that he may not understand how resentful the public mood is following one austerity measure after another since 2010.
Macron doesn't listen to us, but what's worse is that he looks down on us. He still doesn't care about all the protesting, so that's why our goal has to be to block the entire economy with a general strike. That will get his attention.
The general strike of 2019-2020 was the nation's longest labor action ever, but it ultimately failed. The strike shaved only 0.1% off of French economic growth that quarter, showing that a general strike's most powerful aspect may be its ability to shame and discredit those in power.
The biggest economic impact of striking is felt by the workers. The pre-COVID general strike failed because so many workers were just too impoverished to continue a strike that had lasted almost 2 months.
The government did all it could to stretch the general strike out, as their plan was to exhaust the strikers financially. They're using the same tactic now, and that's why we saw more than 4 months of massive protests before they even met with unions to discuss the age hike.
This spring has seen record strikes in other European nations, such as Belgium, Germany, Spain, and even the United Kingdom. Low salaries, record inflation, and perceptions that their governments refuse to democratically recognize the scope of the hardship are all consistently cited as reasons. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
The right to go on strike, to withdraw one's labor over grievances with one's employer, potentially under threat in proposed legislation that gives the British government sweeping powers to clamp down on industrial action.
They say it's democratic when it's not democratic, so they're an affront to democracy with what they want on this bill. And it'll turn worker, they want to turn worker against worker, but it won't. It'll just cause confusion.
Mr. Speaker.
Formerly known as the Minimum Service Level Bill, voted on in Parliament Monday, the legislation enables the government to determine what a minimum level of service should be, with potential consequences for strikers and the unions that represent them.
The unions would face sequestration of their funds, which is obviously a serious, very serious step, and unions can't afford to go down that road. So it will effectively stop strike action in those parts of the economy, but it will also seek to scare people in other parts of the economy about what will happen to them should they take the decision to go on strike.
The freedom to form and join a union and to bargain collectively is one of the four international labour standards which the UK government has signed up to.
The UK is part of the ILO and signed up to all of its conventions. So the right to strike is really a fundamental human right. It's something that we should protect and be very aware of any legislation that seeks to restrict that. And I think internationally people will be concerned that here in the UK we're seeking to restrict that right.
Among the sectors impacted by the legislation, health, education, transport and fire services, all of which have staged several rounds of industrial action over pay and working conditions over the past year in the face of the UK's cost of living crisis.
Strikes became common during the Industrial Revolution. The UK has recognized the right to strike since at least 1906, and the protesters and union leaders here say they're not going to allow that right to be eroded or taken away. Saeed Pereza, London.
Specialists at the Republican Hospital in Donetsk have warned that the number of civilians who have been hospitalized is dramatically on the rise as Ukrainian armed forces are using more advanced NATO-supplied weapons. Almost 1,000 wounded have been treated since the beginning of 2023, the trauma center in Donetsk has reported. Specialists believe that the latest weapons sent by NATO countries are more advanced and lethal.
Until not long ago, only civilians living near the front line got wounded or killed. Now, following the new medium and long-range weapons provided by NATO to Ukraine, we have a much higher number of civilians being hospitalized. Look behind my back. Our hospital was targeted a few weeks ago.
Ukrainian armed formations have shelled hospitals a number of times over the past months. This hospital in central Donetsk, Voroshilovsky district, was hit by the artillery on April 28. That shelling caused 9 civilian casualties and severe damage to the building. On that occasion, among the dead civilians was also a child. 16 people also suffered injuries from the blast. Kyiv's forces fired high-explosive fragmentation missiles produced in Slovakia and transferred to Ukraine by NATO countries.
We have been denouncing this situation since 2015. We started with the European Court of Human Rights, but for inexplicable reasons our case was dismissed. We tried then with the International Criminal Court, but they have never visited the Donbas, and this case was subsequently dismissed. We are now trying to bring it forward to the UN. Will human rights be finally protected here as well?
In fear of attacks on residential areas, kids have been forced to switch to remote learning throughout the whole school year, which, by the way, ends on Tuesday. Max Civili, Donetsk.
To commemorate the 23rd anniversary of the liberation of South Lebanon from Israeli occupation, Hezbollah conducted an unprecedented live military drill in the South Lebanese town of Aramta. After a show of hand-to-hand combat and a parade of all-terrain vehicles and motorcycles, the fighters launched a simulation of taking over an Israeli post in the occupied Galilee area. Over 100 media outlets covered the event, which many say is something unseen since before the liberation in 2000.
The location chosen for this is quite telling. First of all, it's close to the border with Israel. And, of course, this area back in before 2000 was under Israeli occupation. The old Bir Kalab outpost the Israelis had was just up on the hill behind us. So this is very familiar territory for Hezbollah.
The head of Hezbollah's executive council, Sayed Hashem Safieddine, warned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that his cabinet will not be able to change the rules of engagement.
Our message to Israel is clear. If you think that you can launch a full-scale aggression in order to strike the equations of deterrence, which we made with our blood and armaments and strength, we will be ready to shower you with precise rockets, and you will witness black days unlike any other. The Israeli regime knows what we mean. We will use our precise rockets and all means available to us.
Observers see that Hezbollah is primarily seeking psychological warfare against Israel with this maneuver.
But clearly the message is towards the Israelis primarily. As we've seen with the recent escalation in Gaza, we've seen a tightening of the ties, the military ties between Hezbollah, Hamas, Islamic Jihad, and so on. So I think this show today feeds into that.
Hezbollah says the drill sent a message to the Israeli regime about the readiness of the resistance to deter enemy aggression and defend Lebanon. Israeli forces left most of southern Lebanon on May 25, 2000, after 22 years of occupation.
Hezbollah's military drill is not merely a show of force with prospects of a possible confrontation and continuous Israeli aggressions towards Al-Quds. Hezbollah wants to send a clear message to the Israelis that its deterrence capabilities remain intact. Maryam Saleh, South Lebanon.
UNICEF representative for Afghanistan says some 90% of the population in the country is on the brink of poverty, while children are the ones who are bearing the brunt of it. The UNICEF states some 2.3 million children in Afghanistan are expected to face malnutrition in the country, while roughly 1.6 million Afghan children, some as young as 6, are trapped in child labor, working in dangerous conditions just to help their parents put food on the table.
The children pick these waste materials and sell it to me. Instead of going to school, they work to earn a bread worth. These kids are doing this job out of necessity because some of them have sick parents and take care of them, or their parents have no job and tell the children to do this for a living. They can hardly buy bread with this earning.
Mohammad Qasem, a 12-year-old worker, says he can't go to school because he should provide bread for the family.
I am 12 years old. I pick these bottles under the scorching sun to sell and buy bread for the family with this money. I don't go to school because I work every day to earn some money. It has been 3 years that I have been doing this.
Experts believe decades of war and unrest in the country is to blame for the poverty, which is compelling families to send their loved ones on the streets to find a mouthful. But of course, the negative consequences aren't negligible.
Most of the problems in the society originate from poverty. It is due to this poverty that our children are working on the streets. But we should keep in mind that the child who is working on the street is a lost valuable asset without a bright future for the country.
U.S.-led war in Afghanistan has ruined the country's economy. It has also made Afghanistan weapons contaminated too. 134 children were killed or maimed while collecting scrap metal to sell from explosive devices between January and March of this year alone. While Afghanistan is struggling to resolve problems left behind from decades of war, many people here believe U.S. sanctions and the reduction of activities of international organizations have made the situation more complicated in the country. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
The Islamic Jihad Resistance Movement has organized a celebration event in Damascus countryside, marking its victory against Israel in the recent battle in the Gaza Strip. In a televised speech, Secretary General of the movement, Ziad Nakhale, announced the victory against the Israeli regime, expressing pride in the people of Gaza, who he said manufactured their own weapons with the help of member countries of the resistance front.
We succeeded in the battle and we preserved Palestinians' unity. We proved to the enemy our continuous readiness to engage in battle after another in defense of our people. Any assassination operation will be met with a strong, clear and painful response in which Tel Aviv or other Israeli cities will be in the range of our rockets.
The event was attended by representatives of Syria-based Palestinian factions. Speakers said Palestinians and resistance groups showed unprecedented unity through the joint operations room while retaliating against Israel. They rejected any concessions with Israel and refused to acknowledge any political settlement with the enemy.
We underline the importance of national unity and armed resistance, which is the only option we have. We reject concessions, Oslo Accords, or any security coordination or recognition of Israel. We call for boycotting Israel politically and economically and punishing the enemy for the crimes against Palestinians.
Videos were played on a large screen showing the retaliatory battle codenamed Revenge of the Free, including images of the Islamic Jihad leaders who were assassinated or lost their lives while confronting Israeli attacks. Resistance movements like the Islamic Jihad believe that resistance is not an option, but in fact a national duty which is based on the legitimate right of Palestinians to fight against the Israeli regime. And for long, it has been the only successful deterrent against Israeli aggressions in occupied Palestine. Hamad Ali, Damascus Countryside.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me, proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away, proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed, smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. دين الإسلام ديني والعظم غير ديني محمد اللي هديني.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. In the name of God, welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to talk about the rules of taqlid, or following a religious scholar, a jurisprudential scholar, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. I'm Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are still talking about the rules of taqlid based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, you know, somebody asked us this question. I had reached the age of Sharia puberty, when Imam Khomeini was still alive. I followed him in certain rules, but I didn't have a clear notion of taqlid or what taqlid is. What's my duty now?
Well, if he performed the acts of worship according to the imam's opinion and juridical position or fatwa, while, for example, Imam Khomeini was alive, and he was practically a muqallid or a follower of him, even in certain issues and some issues, then he can keep following him in all the issues. You know,
yes.
He is considered a muqallid of Imam Khomeini, and so he can continue following him and stay in his taqlid, no matter how long he may continue to stay in his taqlid. Of course, in matters of Islamic jurisprudence, which are